I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The House passed President Obama's economic recovery bill last night without a single Republican vote. Now the Senate is gearing up for a debate for the ages. That's how Gail Chadwick sees it. Gail's congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She's going to jumpstart our first conversation today. What happens now to the recovery bill, but also to the Republican Party, poised to pick its new leader at the Republican National Committee meeting tomorrow? And House Republicans are also huddling this weekend in Hot Springs, Virginia, to plot the party's future. So, Gail, who joins us from the Monitor studios, what will those House Republicans be saying? You know, great call on standing together against Obama, or what have we done? What do you think?
I think the House Republicans are already looking to the next election. Their main concern is rallying their base, raising money, and coming up with a new position that they can sustain for the next 2 years in the face of a majority party that isn't going to give them anything.
Well, but is it, you know, also in the face of, you know, the headlines that people see, we're hearing that a lot of the things that are in this bill, if passed by the Senate, will be seen immediately, $12 or $13 a week for many American workers in the form of lower tax withholdings, unemployment checks that are supposed to stop are going to keep coming, along with an extra $25 a week. Do Republicans stand to be seen as the people who were trying to stop that?
Absolutely. And I think that's why when the final vote comes, you may see more Republicans on that bill. But it won't be the House bill they're on. It will be the bill that's been negotiated with the Senate. And the Senate is coming up with a bill that has a lot of changes, including Republican ideas. Substantially more tax cuts in the Republican bill. A lot more support for rural areas as opposed to urban areas. That should pull back some of those conservative Republicans from rural districts. So I think the final vote is going to look very different than the vote we saw in the House today, in part because of the effort the president has made to reach out to Republicans.
Well, I mean, just from your point of view, was he not reaching out to House Republicans? That's what they said, and they were complaining about money in the bill that would resod the National Mall, that would provide condoms for the poor, prevent sexually transmitted diseases. Barney Frank on CNN last night said, who do you think counsels people about diseases? These are jobs we're talking about.
That's right.
But Obama responded to those conservative Republican critics by cutting some of the controversial money. So did he try with them or not?
He certainly spent time with them, and it's time that they really appreciated. He's been on the phone with them. But in terms of what the bill looked like, aside from a few examples like that, $200 million for resodding the mall, the family planning money, which the president personally intervened with Democratic leaders on the House side to take out, the bill didn't change in committee under Republican hands in any significant way. And that's what they're looking for. They want the president to leverage more minority rights with Nancy Pelosi. And she's not budging.
So this is more about Nancy Pelosi than Barack Obama.
Yes, it is.
Well, tell us about House Minority Whip Eric Cantor, who, with Minority Leader John Boehner, whipped these Republicans in the House in line. PolitiFact.com says Cantor was wrong in some of his claims, including saying the stimulus bill has $300,000 for a sculpture garden in Miami. They say that claim was such a distortion they gave him a pants on fire rating. But it, you know, he did his job.
He, in his first big outing as Republican whip, delivered a victory that no one expected. Absolutely no Republicans voted with the president's plan, and they're off this weekend on a retreat to, you know, frame up where they're heading.
I guess the question is, you know, who's directing Eric Cantor, or is he in charge of the Republican Party right now? I mean, you know what? At one time, it was Bush, Cheney, Roe, very clear direction from the White House. So who's this Eric Cantor, and who's in charge of Eric Cantor?
He's a very talented relative newcomer, and he's probably the best fundraiser they've ever had. And in that sense, he has taken a lot of the energy back from what is currently a void. You know, who does speak for the Republican Party? Mm-hmm. And the line that he's laying out for them is basically this: we are bloodied. That is, we've made a lot of mistakes in the past, but we're resolute. We're going forward to defend the entrepreneurial spirit of the nation. That term, entrepreneurial, is going to be the keystone for the next 2 years.
That's Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, stay there, because I just want to bring into our conversation Mickey Edwards, former Republican congressman from Oklahoma, now a lecturer at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. His latest book is Reclaiming Conservatism, How a Great American Political Movement Got Lost and How It Can Find Its Way Back. So that sort of tells us, Mickey, where you stand. But where do you stand on, and what do you think Republicans are saying, the different voices, about last night's vote? Are they seeing Republicans finding their way back, or are they seeing that as a mistake?
Well, I think there's no question that Republicans have to let the country see that they understand the scope of the problems that we face, and the number of people who are out of work and who stood to lose their benefits. I think it's important that whether it's Eric Cantor or John Boehner or whoever is speaking most loudly for the party doesn't get the wrong message out there, where it looks like Republicans just don't care. But in this particular case, the bill that was on the floor was really not Barack Obama's. Obama did reach out, I think, quite well. He kept his promise. But this was really David Obey's bill. And it did have a lot of things in it that Republicans felt were not stimulus, but were more, fulfilling a longstanding Democratic wish list. And so in terms of whether or not Barack Obama should be able to force Nancy Pelosi to be more accommodating and listen more to Republicans. The Congress doesn't work for the president, and he will have his influence, and he will be able to make his appeals. But the Congress is going to do what it's going to do, even if the president's of the same party.
Well, you mentioned David Obey, congressman from Wisconsin, as being one of the authors. But, you also spoke about voices, and I don't think many Americans are listening to Eric Cantor. The Republican congressmen were. But who do you think they are listening to? Gail, jump in on this as well, because our sense is that they're hearing Rush Limbaugh or Ann Coulter. Here's Rush Limbaugh in a recent interview with Fox News invoking Ronald Reagan.
What we need to be doing is Reagan, very simple, made the people of this country understand that its greatness is due to them. They're the ones who make the country work, not policies, not laws, not committees in Congress and so forth, and not cult heroes or personalities, but individual freedom, people excelling.
Well, and Gail, is this a problem? That sort of invoking that idea that, government isn't policies and laws and committees aren't what works, when most Americans can plainly see that Wall Street and banks need to be reined in, that there needs to be, regulating of mortgage lenders, that peanut manufacturers might need a few more federal inspectors, as we're going to hear in a minute. That's all government.
There was an interesting survey that Stan Greenberg, who's a Democratic pollster, brought out this week, looking at the 40 most competitive districts for Democrats. These are former Republican districts. And he is claiming that there is a very strong support for a stimulus plan there, precisely for that reason, that it's one thing to talk about slogans, individual freedom and so forth, helping the taxpayer. But if you've lost your job and you're no longer paying taxes, the picture looks different. And that's the argument that Democrats have been hammering Republicans with.
And Mickey,
who are you talking about?
Right. And Mickey Edwards, you wrote a recent column in which you said Ronald Reagan would be maybe amazed by the way his name's being invoked.
Well, I think Ronald Reagan would have been amazed if he had heard that comment by Rush Limbaugh, because Reagan was very, very clear that while he thought government could go too far and that the strength of the country was in its citizens, there is a role for government. And Reagan repeatedly said, including in one of his inaugurals, that he was not anti-government and that he was for government that promoted prosperity. And the problem is that it's the people like Rush Limbaugh and Ann Coulter, who have in fact gotten the ear of a lot of the American people and gotten them angry, and it's sort of an incoate kind of an anger. They're just mad, and they believe that Limbaugh is their source of information, and they believe that they're learning things from Limbaugh that they're not getting out of the media, and they really have a very distorted view of what's happening.
Well, and this is, you know, you are a Republican yourself, but you I'm sure say you represent the small but moderate wing of the party.
No, I'm not a moderate.
Well, how would you say it?
Yeah. I am a conservative, just as Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan were, and it's the people like Limbaugh and Coulter who are not conservatives. They're some kind of reactionary force that has come into the party, but you know, there's nothing conservative about their point of view.
Well, but they are, as you said, getting listened to. I just wanted the Reagan lines, because some people may be saying, well, wait a second, Ronald Reagan said government's not the solution to our problem, government is the problem, but you point out he later said, it's not my intention to do away with government, it's rather to make it work.
Well, he actually said that in the very same speech.
Ah, okay, there you go. But what happens now to both of you, Mickey Edwards and Gail Chadwick? Republicans huddling to pick a new party leader. You know, some saying the Republicans have sort of, you know, maybe lost their way after the last election. But the Weekly Standard's William Kristol says, no, I see this as a liberation. I don't see this as a problem. Gail, your thoughts on that. What happens after this weekend, and what needs to happen going into it?
Well, I don't see a leadership turnover at this point, but I do see a real struggle for a message. And I think it's interesting that Republicans in their alternative, House Republicans in their alternative plan, included $34 billion for expanded jobless benefits. So they are, you know, tipping their message to expand the social safety net in some sense. But the big fight they're facing is over expansion in the scope of government. That is what Limbaugh is concerned about in the stimulus plan, that there are a lot of elements that look like a permanent expansion of government, a permanent expansion of entitlement. And that's going to be a much more sophisticated argument, and it's going to have to be made in a way that people can understand.
And Mickey,
and I think that's going to be the challenge for leaders on both sides of the aisle.
Right. And Mickey Edwards, can Republican Committee send a message with the selection of the new leader? I mean, some people, you know, except for Howard Dean, you know, the occasional party leader that really jumps in your face, most people don't know.
Well, I think it's going to be very important because, you know, if the party turns to somebody like a Michael Steele, they're saying, you know, we've heard your message. We're going to turn the corner. We're going to let the American people understand that we do know the problems they're facing, and we're going to broaden our appeal.
That's the African-American former lieutenant governor of Maryland, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, but if they reelect, for example, the same chairman who served as a spokesperson for the Bush administration, which is one of the things that they're looking at doing, you know, I think it sends exactly the wrong message. The American people need to know that the Republican Party, you know, understands why it was rejected. You know, it wasn't just a matter of Obama sweeping people off their feet. You know, the people turned against the Republican Party, which ran a very anti-intellectual, very nativist campaign. And the selection of a new national chairman has to reflect that message was received.
Mickey Edwards, former Republican congressman, now a lecturer at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. We are also speaking with Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor, looking a little bit ahead as the Republicans do meet this weekend to powwow. Both of you, thanks so much for giving us some of your time.
Thank you.
And just ahead, well, why didn't the government know more about that tainted peanut facility in Georgia? We'll tell you more about that back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back. Well, the Peanut Corporation of America, PCA, has expanded its recall to include all its peanut products dating back to 2007 in what the FDA says is one of the largest food recalls ever. Cookies, crackers, pet treats, ice cream, not peanut butter in jars, but anything made with peanut paste from the Georgia facility, is being pulled from stores and kitchen cabinets after more than 500 people were sickened and 8 died, allegedly because of salmonella in the supplier's peanut paste. Inspectors found roaches, mold, and leaks at the plant. And federal officials say the company knowingly shipped contaminated paste 12 times in the past 2 years. How can that be? Jean Halloran is food safety expert at Consumers Union. They're the publishers of Consumer Reports. She joins us from their studio in New York. And Jean, we understand one of the answers to that question may be something called lab shopping. You know, companies go to different labs to get the result they're looking for? Well, it's not completely clear what PCA did, but they tested everything twice. When they found a salmonella positive in peanut butter or a peanut product, they tested it again, possibly at a different lab, and got a negative result, after which they shipped it out to the public.
Right. The Washington Post is reporting that in several cases, the company, PCA, had just different labs analyze the products and had different results. We hear from some analysts that this might be more common than we think.
Yes, that may be true. I don't believe there's a law against it. In fact, the companies don't even have to report to FDA when they find salmonella in their product.
Well, this was something that really jumped out at us, that in fact, when companies have these internal lab tests, they're not required to tell anyone.
That's correct. In fact, when FDA finally did an inspection this month, they had to use their authority under the Bioterrorism Act to get access to the company's records.
Well, and something else that jumped out at us is the state requirements. State inspection reports show the plant did have a history of unsanitary conditions, this according to the Washington Post, but the state is saying that it didn't recently test for salmonella.
Yes, that's correct. They inspected the plant a couple times in the last year, but didn't bother to do a salmonella test. It's hard to understand why they wouldn't, since we had a terrible problem with another peanut butter plant just 2 years ago with salmonella.
Well, and they say that they can only run about 4,000 samples or tests a year because they have 16,000 processing plants and they can't get to them all. I mean, is that one of the headlines from this story, that we just, there's no way to inspect everything?
Well, our food safety efforts are completely underfunded and understaffed at this point. I mean, one reason that Georgia was responsible was because FDA itself did not have the staff and capability to go down there. So it farmed out the work to Georgia inspectors. But FDA's inspection staff has been cut by about 90% over the last couple decades.
So what happens now? Is this peanut paste supplier, again, we reinforce the Peanut Corporation of America supplies paste to companies that use it in other products. The peanut butter in jars is still considered safe. But are they liable, especially if they, you know, if they had tests that showed salmonella results?
They also, by the way, distributed peanut butter to institutions like schools and nursing homes under the names King Nut and Parnell's Pride. And I would say if any consumer has a child in school or a parent in a nursing home, you might check with them to make sure that they don't have any of this product on the shelves.
Right, if you're throwing it out in your kitchen, but if a child is still getting it at school, it's not helping.
Right. But are they liable? Well, they certainly will be liable under our product liability laws. Someone will have to bring suit, of course, although such cases are notoriously difficult to win because you have to prove that it was peanut butter that made the person sick, that there weren't other contributing causes, that it was that which caused the severity of the illness, and it was in this company's peanut butter. So there are a lot of hurdles to winning a product liability suit.
Well, and we should say that the director of the FDA Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition is declining to say if the company is going to face any criminal charges. So what happens now to consumers? We're hearing more and more products that might have this peanut butter paste in it. Jenny's Cuisine, Anytime Peanut Butter Flavor Nutritional Bars from Jenny Craig, a lot of kinds of the Carolina Prime Pet dog treats. What do people do?
Well, consumers have to be very, very careful, and to some degree, they're on their own here. This is such a massive recall. They can't really expect that government officials will all be pulling the products off the shelves. Clif Bars, there's some Trader Joe's products. The list is, I think, now over 200 products, quite a long list. You can access a list of all the products that have been recalled at FDA.gov. And if you have any question, FDA itself says, better safe than sorry, don't eat the food unless you're absolutely sure, as a result of assurances from the manufacturer, that the product is not one of those from PCA. About the only things we can be really sure are safe at this point are peanut butter that you buy in jars in the supermarket and Girl Scout cookies.
Oh, And I just threw a box out. The Girl Scouts had made a released a statement saying that their peanut butter Girl Scout cookies were not affected.
Yes, they've documented that their peanut ingredients came from other plants.
Well, and just a quick question, because we know, for instance, a company like Keebler uses the contaminated paste for their crackers. Now, of course, all of those are being pulled from the shelves, but what happens to their equipment? Doesn't it get contaminated?
Well, I'm sure it must be, and all of these companies will have to engage in really thorough cleanup and sterilization to make sure none of the salmonella bacteria is lurking anywhere in their equipment. One of the really tricky things about this is that apparently salmonella goes into a dormant stage when it's in peanut butter, and then when it gets inside a person in a nice, warm, moist environment, it starts to multiply.
Oh, joy. That's Jean Halloran. She's a food safety expert at Consumers Union, the publishers of Consumer Reports, and we'll link you to them at our website as well, here-now.org. Jean, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, remembering Andrew Wyeth, we'll hear a rare interview with the late American artist and wild stories from his longtime friend Thomas Hoving. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, fans and players in Phoenix are saying, are you sure? Us? Really? As the Arizona Cardinals get ready for Sunday's Super Bowl. Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
First of all, it is fitting that the very first bill that I signed, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Restoration Act.
That's President Barack Obama today, moments before signing into law the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Restoration Act, named for the woman standing by his side and introduced to thunderous applause. Lilly Ledbetter of Alabama is 70 now, but for 19 years she was a supervisor at a Goodyear tire and rubber plant. Just before retirement, a coworker slipped her a pay list, and she saw she'd been paid less than male colleagues doing the same job. She sued, but the Supreme Court said too late, ruling in 2007 that a person must file a discrimination claim within 180 days of a company's first paycheck giving a worker less than another doing the same job. As if workers in their first few months at work know what other workers make. That's the thinking behind the new law, under which each discriminatory paycheck gives the worker another 180 days to sue. Opponents say the bill will encourage lawsuits, be a boon to trial lawyers, and encourage employees to wait to file claims till the pay stakes might be higher. But President Obama said today his own grandmother was a Lilly Ledbetter, and there are others.
While this bill bears her name, Lilly knows that this story isn't just about her. It's the story of women across this country still earning just 78 cents for every dollar men earn. Women of color, even less. Which means that today, in the year 2009, countless women are still losing thousands of dollars in salary, income, and retirement savings over the course of a lifetime.
Well, Lilly Ledbetter seems to be the new face of workers' rights. Last week, she stood by Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid as he announced plans to revive the Employee Free Choice Act. That bill died in Congress in 2007, and it would change the way employees vote to unionize. Advocacy groups have launched a combined $20 million advertising blitz to get their versions of the facts about the act out there as it's coming back to life. For a look at how this ad war is shaping up, Here and Now media analyst and Boston University mass communication professor John Carroll joins us. John, hello.
Hi, Robin.
Now, we've covered the Employee Free Choice Act here before, but remind us, what does it do?
Basically, what it does is it changes the landscape in the workplace so that unions can have a secret ballot, the traditional secret ballot, if they want, but they can also opt for signing cards. And if people just sign cards and enough people sign them, they can organize the workplace.
Right. And let's remind ourselves, right now, under the current law, unions hand out signing cards to people and they sign up if they get a certain majority. Then the National Labor Relations Board and the company takes over a process where they talk to the workers about unions and then they have that secret vote.
Right. And what the unions say is employers have this open forum where they can lobby the workers all the time, and it's very hard for the unions to get in touch with the workers, to assemble the workers, to deliver their message. And so basically what they're saying is that the playing field is not level.
They want the process to end after the handing out of the union cards. I mean, right now, the unions hand out the cards and people sign up, but then once it's taken over by the company, the unions aren't even allowed to come inside the
building.
Right.
They have to catch them outside. Right. And what are you going to do? You're going to catch them on their way home? Probably not.
Right. So the unions wanted to stop after the signing of the cards. They want that to be the way that unions can organize, or if a particular union wants to, they can go forward and have the secret election. Let's listen to some of the ads that are out there. This one is from the group, the Center for Union Facts Against Unions and the New Law. Their ad takes place in an elementary school classroom where the class is voting on class president. Let's listen.
What if labor bosses controlled class elections?
Thanks for your votes.
I want to assure you that a vote for me is best for you. Ms. Hudgens has just agreed that there isn't going to be any secret vote. Just sign these cards showing us who you like the best, and my campaign committee will collect and count them.
Okay, John Carroll, the point being, besides the fact that union bosses are supposed to talk funny, what's the point of the ad?
Well, the point of the ad is that this gives the unions the power to strong-arm the workers, and also by bringing it out, it puts an inordinate amount of pressure on workers to agree to unionize the workplace.
Okay. The pro-union group, American Rights at Work, they have their own ads and, of course, an opposing opinion. Now, this ad is very tongue-in-cheek. It starts with a rather well-fed-looking businessman in a suit on a seesaw. There's one single employee on the other end of the seesaw, sort of dangling in the air. But as the benefits of unions are discussed, more workers get on that other side of the seesaw and balance it out. Eventually, it's the CEO stuck up in the air. Let's listen.
CEOs' salaries and benefits are getting fatter and fatter, while workers face soaring gas prices, foreclosures, and rising health care costs. The Employee Free Choice Act gives workers the freedom to form a union so they can earn better wages, retirement security, and health care coverage.
This ad is all about the balance of power, not to play off the seesaw too much. Basically, this is about who's got the power in these union organizing efforts. And right now, according to the unions, the power is all on the side of the employer. So what they want to do is illustrate that this will shift the balance and give unions more of an influence over this process, which is what they want. Only 7.5% of the private sector is unionized, and they're looking around saying, why don't we have a better presence out there?
Well, both sides in those ads seem to be leaning toward hyperbole. How shocking.
Yeah. This is a really complicated issue, and it's ripe for distortion. It's one of those issues where you can cherry pick certain things and magnify them and in the process distort them. Basically, these ads are a way for each side to set the context so that when this actually comes up on Capitol Hill, people will have already formed a perception of what this battle is about, who's right, who's wrong, and they will bring that to bear when it becomes a bigger issue.
John Carroll, you know, having looked at all the ads and having looked at the issue closely, do you think it's true that no matter what happens, employees are going to be potentially intimidated by somebody?
I think you can make that case that, again, the balance of power is going to shift in one direction or another, and there's nothing to say that unions couldn't adopt some of the same techniques that that employers have adopted to try to influence the vote.
And just briefly, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says a vote won't come on the new bill until this summer, but here we have already this, $10 million on each side ad campaign. Do you see them swaying public opinion or lawmakers?
I think that what they're trying to do is a couple of things. One thing they're trying to do is drive news coverage. Another thing they're trying to do is get the true believers mobilized so that when this does come to the floor on Capitol Hill, that they'll have people who are ready to take some kind of action or vocalize their position. The third is to just set the context, to try to somehow telegraph to the public what the stakes are here.
Well, and the other thing that may have a bigger effect than the ads is the newscast around the ads. People either see more people being laid off and think, I better get a secure job with a union, or see more people being laid off and say, I better not rock the boat.
Exactly. So it can cut both ways. And the same facts are being used by both sides to make their points. So it's one of those issues where language has a lot to do with how they're positioning themselves. And language, in a way, is being used to obscure facts as much as to reveal them.
John Carroll here now, media analyst and Boston University mass communication professor. Professor Carroll, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
And as always, we want to hear your thoughts on this or anything on the program. Just taking a second to let you know our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. And you can always call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. Keep calling until you feel you've gotten it right. You're listening to Here and Now. As the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Arizona Cardinals prepare to face off in Sunday's Super Bowl in Tampa, Florida, manatees and sea turtles at the Sarasota Aquarium weighed in with their predictions. Three of the animals preferred the Steelers logo hanging on a target in their tank. Only one chose the Cardinals. Well, you know, the Steelers have been to this party before. They've won six Super Bowls. The Washington Post is calling the Cardinals party crashers. They've only had two winning seasons since the team moved from St. Louis in the 80s. No Super Bowls. And as both teams stream onto the field at Tampa's Raymond James Stadium on Sunday, Cardinal fans and players may be pinching themselves. KJZZ's Mark Moran has their story in Phoenix.
Breaks a tackle at the 15. He letters it again. It's picked off by Dockett. Dockett running near side at the 15. Dockett inside the 10. That's it. The Cardinals have shocked the world. Trey Petrou. The Cards have done it. They're going to Super Bowl 43.
Until the Arizona Cardinals' victory against the Eagles earlier this month, the Cards hadn't won any kind of championship since 1947, when the Chicago Cardinals played in wool uniforms with leather helmets and no face masks on Soldier Field. Now, Arizonans, including Mesa resident and Cardinals season ticket holder Brian Shackelford, hardly know what to think when he hears the national media pundits talk about the Arizona Cardinals.
And whether they're saying that they're going to lose this week, just the simple fact that they're saying the Cardinals' name over the airways on the national media is such a shock to have the announcer say that the Pittsburgh Steelers have earned the right to play the Arizona Cardinals in the Super Bowl.
Sure, the Cards won their division and made the playoffs, but only after limping into the end of the season by losing four of their last six games. NBC's Chris Collinsworth called this the worst playoff team in history, and almost everybody seemed to agree with him. After Arizona's first-round victory over the Falcons, coach Ken Wisenhunt made a full lap around Cardinal Stadium, thanking fans because even he wasn't sure they'd be back to play again at home. But now that they're in the Super Bowl, the bandwagon is wobbling under the sheer weight. Jerry Lugo, clad in an old Cards t-shirt, says he's been watching the same old sorry Cardinals since he was a little boy. And when they beat the Eagles to finally get to the Super Bowl,
half my family was crying, and I even wanted to share a tear or two, but we were suffering for a long time. Yeah, we had some family members that passed away, diehard fans, and we finally did it for them too.
Okay, so there may be some true diehards who really did believe from the beginning. But if you listen carefully to the post-NFC championship words of 37-year-old graybeard quarterback Kurt Warner, you can almost hear his disbelief.
When everybody counted us out, when everybody counted me out, when everybody told us every single week, well, okay, Cardinals don't have a chance against Atlanta. They definitely don't have a chance against Carolina, and they really don't have a chance against Philadelphia. And then to accomplish that, I think, is really, really special.
With just a few days to go before the Super Bowl, there's still plenty of time for every possible storyline. And here's an interesting twist. Kurt Warner came to Arizona because nobody else would give him a chance, and coach Ken Wisenhunt came here because he was passed over for the head coaching job in, of all places, Pittsburgh, which ironically the Cards will face in the Super Bowl.
Did you expect anything different? When we actually won the game, how could it not have been the Steelers? That was what I expected. So, you know, it's just a shame that there won't be many storylines this week because of these two matchups.
One part of the storyline has not changed throughout the postseason. The Cardinals are underdogs in Tampa. Pittsburgh is favored to win Super Bowl 43 by a touchdown. But that's not dimming the enthusiasm of Cardinals fan Jerry Lugo.
They're going to take the championship. They got to win the Super Bowl because we've been waiting for too long.
Well, Cardinals fans will believe that when they see it.
That's Mark Moran of KJZZ in Phoenix. Okay, some of you may think the fix is already in. I said the Steelers have won 6 championships. I am not predicting they're looking to win their 6th this Sunday. And we have no pony in this. We're Pats fans. So not to leave the Steelers fans out, they're holding a Cage the Cards rally. Get it? Birdcage, Cardinals. Today in downtown Pittsburgh, look for our colleague Doug Sugarts. And here is the Steelers fight song written and performed by Steelers fan Roger Wood.
Here we go. Here we go. Here we go. Steelers, here we go. Pittsburgh's gone to Super Bowl.
Okay, and here we go to a quick break. We'll be back with the RPM Challenge. You're listening to Here and Now.
It's town of Pittsburgh's heart and soul.
And I wait for the tide to go out.
Welcome back.
So I can put my feet in cold sand and feel the rocks beneath my skin. And I
That's the pensive band, The Governess, with their song Level One. They were big in last year's RPM Challenge. RPM stands for Record Production Month. Yes, if you sign up, you have 1 month to record an original album of 10 songs or 35 minutes, whichever comes first. But just 1 month. Anyone can enter. You don't have to be a professional or even have a recording studio. And participants come from all over the world.
Again, dampness seeps into your bones. Pull a black knit cap over already soaked hair.
One day when I was out riding, I saw myself a funny sight. This train was broke down on the tracks, so I rode with all my might.
That's the Bilgerats of Kansas City, Missouri. Before that, Kristen Miller from Georgetown, Massachusetts. And to start, we had the Lake Situation from Berkhamsted, England. The 4th annual RPM Challenge starts this Sunday, and it's not too late to get in on it. Dave Karlatsky is publisher of The Wire newspaper, one of the Challenger's organizers. He joins us from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord. Dave, welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Tell us about the challenge. I mean, what do you have to do?
You just have to record 10 songs or 35 minutes of original material during the 28 days of February. It's really just about setting aside whatever stopping you from working on your music and getting it done, whether it's a question of an album that you would have put off otherwise or whether it's a question of doing something that you wouldn't have done normally. Like if maybe you're an established musician and you've already got some stuff in the works, but you set aside February and do something completely different.
Well, you just said a couple of interesting things. First of all, the 28 days of February. So it's not just 1 month. It's the shortest month.
You know, absolutely.
Even less time. And I'm wondering, are there hard, fast rules? Let's say you could sort of cheat. You could, knowing the RPM challenge is coming, you could write the music all year and then record it in a month. Are there any restrictions?
Well, the hard and fast rules are that it has to be original material and it has to be recorded in February. The text of the challenge does say that we really encourage people to write the material in February as well, but it's not a contest. It's a creative challenge for individuals, so you get out of it what you put into it.
Well, you started locally in the first year of the challenge in 2005. You've gone global. We've got a cut here from a band from St. John's, Newfoundland. It's AM/FM Dreams. Let's hear their Flying Machine. You know, Dave, that's pretty darn good. Is it all good?
Lots of it is really great. There's kind of a double-edged thing with the RPM Challenge where the purpose really is not to produce polished, radio-ready work. What we get to hear at the end is that when musicians do set aside their preconceptions and when they do get down to work and when they're willing to try things they wouldn't normally try, because this isn't an album that you're going to be judged on, there's a great energy and a great creative power that comes out of it, and we hear wonderful things.
Right.
Especially we're going into our fourth year now, and we're in the unique position of being able to see some long-term effects, which are really gratifying. We started it in 2006 in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and there are bands playing now that came together for the RPM Challenge that are still playing out, or bands that, you know, couldn't participate this year because they're too busy touring. You know, it's wonderful to see people getting together and their art changing because of the time that they committed and the work that they put into this fun project.
Right, because you put out collection albums, but you also have a virtual jukebox online. Let's listen to another song from the jukebox. That's the band Walter Sickert and the Army of Broken Toys. It's a track called Carnal Carnival.
So much fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's just an interesting sound that maybe he wouldn't have come up with if he wasn't under this deadline pressure. And I'm wondering, what does happen? Because we understand, you know, in the beginning of the month, you might get some entrants trickling in, but then suddenly what?
All the albums have to either be hand-delivered or postmarked by noon on March 1st. And especially the first year we did it, the end of the day, and the last day of February, we had about 65 albums had been turned in, and we thought, oh my goodness, this is incredible for just from our community. But then the next day, on March 1st, we had another 90 bands come in and turn in their CDs. People who hadn't slept at all that night, their hair was all different directions. And they all streamed in through the door and handed us their CDs and said, oh, you better listen to this.
You better listen to this. I just stayed up all night. Stop trying so hard. I am like a lion from Zion. Stop trying so hard. I am like a lion from Zion. Stop trying so hard. I think I smell your brain cells frying. It's like, I am like a lion from Zion. Stop trying so hard. I am like a lion from Zion. Stop trying so hard. Like a lion from Zion, I'm trying so hard. I think I smell your brain cells frying. This is Brooknology's The Jungle from the RPM Challenge. It's a war for the battle of hearts and minds. The souls of the people. EK, Vision, Genesis. I want to be careful here because, you know, we applaud anyone who decides they're going to get out a boombox or get on their computer and make an album in a month. But is there something that's just been, you know, just so, oh, bad, you know, but that you've had to just applaud them for trying?
Well, I would hesitate to say bad because that's really, again, that's
subjective,
sort of
yes.
not what that's yes. kind of not what we're about. But there was a pinch crotch. God love them. They sent in 28 CDs, each one full of sound, which I don't even think they would call music.
Well, you know, pinch crotch will do that. So, Dave, how many people do you have signed up this year?
So far, we have just over 1,000 folks.
Wow.
From all over. It's really exciting. They're from Tanzania, from Newfoundland, from all across the U.S., from England. We're really excited this year because we've been working with some other weekly papers around the country. They are all bringing RPM into their community and trying to make it a community event in their towns. And so we're seeing a lot of people signing up from that, which is fun.
That's Dave Karolatsky, publisher of The Wire newspaper in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, one of the organizers of the fourth annual RPM Challenge, recording an entire album during the month of February. For more about the challenge, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Dave, thanks so much.
Thank you.